That's Johnny Hodges with Joe's Blues, recorded in 1965. Hodges, of course, on alto sax. Lawrence Brown on trombone. Wild Bill Davis on that jazz organ. Grant Green on guitar. Bob Bushnell on bass. And Grady Tate on drums. What a collection. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, September the 18th. And as the investigation continues into Monday's bloody mass killing at the U.S. Navy headquarters in Washington, D.C., Kathleen Alexis, the mother of Aaron Alexis, the alleged gunman, expresses sorrow and is deeply distressed at what has happened. She says, quote, "Our son, Aaron Alexis, has murdered 12 people and wounded several others. His actions have had a profound and everlasting effect on the families of the victims. I don't know why he did what he did, and I'll never be able to ask him why. Aaron is now in a place where he can no longer do harm to anyone, and for that, I am glad. To the families of the victims, I am so, so very sorry that this has happened. My heart is broken." Well, obviously, we know how distressing these things can be for anyone connected with such a tragedy and to the tragic figure at the center of it. Of course, the press are outside, as they are likely to do, and it's sometimes really annoying that they do this. They have swarmed on the street where Mrs. Alexis lives in Brooklyn, and they have camped outside of her building. And, of course, it's causing even greater distress, but this is what happens in situations like these where the pressure to get the story almost always gets in the way of people's private right to grieve. So that's where things stand, and they're beginning, of course, to dig deeper and deeper into this killing. There's no easy answer anywhere. Also today, we have signals in Washington, D.C., that a huge fight is brewing and that the Republicans have changed both course and strategy as the deadline ends for funding the government, risking a government shutdown. House Speaker John Boehner did an abrupt turnaround today, and on two counts. One, he is inviting the Tea Party lawmakers once again, the conservative element, back into the Republican Party as a team effort to gang up on Obamacare. The idea is to take a vote to defund Obamacare. What was supposed to happen was that the House was supposed to vote on two bills separately. One bill to extend funding, a stopgap measure, as it were, to continue to allow the federal governmental agencies to operate. And the other was this vote on Obamacare. Well, there were supposed to be two separate bills, but Boehner has decided that they will tie them together. So this way, as a strategy, the Senate will not have the option of choosing which bill to vote on. They must now vote on both bills. And this way also, if the bills were separate, Boehner is thinking, the White House, after the Senate votes on that particular bill, which is the funding bill, would then send it to the White House, and of course the flow of funds will continue so that there will be no possible shutdown come Friday. So that's what he has decided to do. He has decided that as a strategy, they will tie both bills together. The president, of course, is fuming, saying that there's never been a situation where a bill already approved by both houses of Congress, he's referring, of course, to Obamacare, will now be put again to another vote, and this time to defund it. So that's a huge battle brewing. It's risky on all sides politically, and we'll see where it goes. But there is going to be a huge fight between today and Friday. Friday is the deadline day. If there is no movement on emergency funds to continue to allow federal agencies to operate, there will be a shutdown, and it will have massive effect. So it's hardball in Washington. Other things are happening too. President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil has decided that she will not honor a previously planned visit to the United States, a state visit to the United States, because of the NSA issue of U.S. spying on the government and governmental officials in Brazil. She was not at all diplomatic. Her spokesman said that this was because of, quote, the illegal interception of communications data belonging to citizens, companies, and members of the Brazilian government, and it constitutes a grave matter, an assault on national sovereignty and individual rights, and are incompatible with relations between friendly nations. That was a statement from the president's office. Meanwhile, the President Obama's state spokesperson is stating that the president, quote, understands and regrets, unquote, the decision by Brazil's president, and nonetheless is committed to working together with President Rousseff and her government in diplomatic channels to move beyond this issue, which is a source of tension in our bilateral relationship. Interestingly, she moves beyond this. This is President Rousseff. She has ordered a series of measures aimed at greater Brazilian control of the internet. And this way, it is her thinking, the servers that Brazilians use should also be based in Brazil. And she considers this part of cyber sovereignty. Now, this is very interesting because what this does is immediately, because Brazil is a huge market, it will be the first such move to fracture U.S. domination of cyberspace. And already companies like Facebook and Google and Yahoo and others are very concerned because this now moves a sizable chunk of their revenues and their control and influence away from them and into the hands of Brazil. This is one thing. The other thing is that it would possibly start a domino effect. Other countries may follow the same lead. And what we will have is a fracturing, a complete smash-up of the U.S. domination of cyberspace. That's very interesting. It's a very bold move, and a lot of money is at stake. It could mean, if it's done immediately, some estimates are that it would immediately cost $35 billion in lost business. Little attention has been given to the fact that President Obama has actually waived anti-terrorism provisions to arm Syrian rebels. The Arms Export Control Act allows the U.S. President to waive provisions in sections 40 and 40A, which forbid providing munitions, credit, and licenses to countries supporting acts of terrorism. But those prohibitions can be waived, quote, if the president determines that the transaction is essential to the national security interests of the United States, unquote. Well, the president thinks that it is in the national interest of the United States to supply opposition forces in Syria with help, quote unquote, whatever that means. The Obama administration is saying that it is providing help only to, quote, selected, vetted members of the opposition forces, which is very interesting how you can do that. And this supposedly was to shore up opposition resistance to any further use of chemical weapons in Syria. But the sticking point is that the opposition, more than half of the opposition, seeking to topple President Bashar al-Assad, are jihadists, including groups like al-Nusra and al-Qaeda that, in fact, the United States considers terrorist organizations. So the president has given himself permission to assist terrorist organizations in Syria. Meanwhile, of course, with the help of the CIA, help has already been flowing into the hands of the opposition in Syria. They supposedly are not smuggling weapons, but things like equipment and other materials that would help them in the fight against Assad. The United States has decided that it should seize, and it will seize, a major skyscraper, as they called, at that time they were called skyscrapers, it's a tower in Manhattan at 655th Avenue, that has links, according to the Justice Department, to the Iranian government. And it is part of a, the Justice Department is saying that it is part of a tactic to relieve the terrorist-linked state of its assets when it is found to be aiding and abetting terrorism. It's said to be the largest forfeiture authorized by a federal court. But a federal judge in Manhattan has given the Justice Department the go-ahead to seize the building now owned by the Alavi Foundation and Asa Corporation, which allegedly took part in money laundering, according to the Justice Department. And because it was laundering money, it was in fact functioning as a front for the government of Iran, which the United States insists was engaging and assisting terrorists at the time. The building is to be sold. It is worth between $500 million and $700 million. Dollars. And the proceeds, according to the Justice Department, will go toward helping the victims of Iranian-sponsored terrorism. Well, we know what that is. We see it as a ramping up of actions. It's an aggressive action against Iran. And this is the way things creep up and become, at some point, a point of no return. Hostilities ensue, and wars ensue the hostilities. What I want to talk today about is American democracy, a matter of dollars and cents, common sense. A very startling study was published in Forbes magazine that collectively the personal fortunes of 400 of the wealthiest Americans, just 400, their collective personal fortunes estimated at $2.02 trillion, an all-time high, exceeds Russia's economy. I want to repeat that. The collective personal fortunes of just 400 of America's wealthiest people, $2.02 trillion, exceeds the economy of Russia. And in the meantime, on the flip side of the coin, we have 46.5 million Americans, that is to say 15% of this nation, living in poverty. The income gap between rich and poor is the widest it has been in almost 100 years. These and other figures and statistics aren't just telling a story about the lopsidedness of the U.S. economy. They're saying that the political system that has delivered these realities, that makes these realities possible, is woefully off kilter. Something is woefully wrong. In other words, you really have to rethink this notion of democracy. Why do I say that? Because democracy is really not about voting at all, and we need to see that. Yes, people vote, and yes, people are saying, yeah, when you vote, you are literally participating in one of the fundamental exercises of democracy. So people associate voting, not just associated voting with democracy. They think voting is democracy, and that's not it at all. So how do we measure democracy? What are we supposed to understand about that word, that notion, that concept, if it's not about voting? I want to encourage a discussion that democracy really is to be measured very differently in the eyes of the electorate. Democracy is to be measured by the degree and the quality of access that the electorate has to the strategic resources of the society. If it turns out that people have relatively unfettered access to the resources of society in an even fashion, an across-the-board fashion, then we would have something that I would say is democracy. But when we see this kind of lopsidedness, that is not democracy. What do I mean by strategic resources? Every society has what could be considered strategic resources. Employment, for example, is a strategic resource. Quality health care is a strategic resource. Education is a strategic resource. Affordable housing is a strategic resource. Employment is a strategic resource. These are the fundamentals. These are not huge concepts pulled out of the air. This is just the way it is in all societies. All societies have these resources. And how they are apportioned, how they are accessed, how people get to them and get them, that is where you see democracy at work or not. In a society, say, like Sweden or Switzerland or Canada, you see people involved in accessing these resources in a very different way from the way Americans access these resources, and who gets to access them, and how much. You can't have a society where the rich are literally doing the best they have ever done. It's an all-time high. Their wealth is shooting through the roof. They can't help but make more money. And you have the Grand Canyon separating that group from most other Americans, and yet another huge chasm separating those people from the folks at the bottom of the ladder. When President Obama says that he is the standard bearer for the middle class, the message he is giving is, I am here to assist you to get more access, better access to the strategic resources of our society, better employment opportunities, better opportunities to own your own home, better opportunities to send your children to better schools so that they could be educated for the jobs America will be generating now and in the future. The people at the bottom rung of this ladder, they don't matter at all. The message is, be grateful if you have access at all. And we know what causes poverty. Poor people. Poor people cause poverty. That is the thinking. And those are the messages that we're getting from this administration. You can't tell me that this is a fair deal. You're not envying the rich. People are entitled to use their brains and ingenuity and whatever it is to amass wealth. That's great. I have no problem with that. But in as much as these strategic resources are government controlled, then the government has some accounting to do with how it leverages this access. And this is what the people need to understand. It's not about voting. And you vote for the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever party. That's not democracy at all. You have to pay attention to the simple question. At the base level, how do we quantify our access to these resources? Can we say we have a fair shot and we have been getting a fair shot? Can we say that everybody has a chance, not just hypothetically, but really, realistically? And the answer clearly is no. If people have been paying attention, they would have noticed that several different commemorations have been occurring beginning last month and into this month. The 50th anniversary of this, and the 50th anniversary of that. the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for what? Jobs and freedom. These are strategic resources. So this is not a sentimental stroll down memory lane. People should interpret this to mean that for 50 years, and I keep saying that that's a wrong calculation because you're placing this in 1963 when the March for Justice and Freedom actually was supposed to occur in 1941. And they'd been negotiating all along between 1941 and 1963. But it says, not that this was about the power of the grassroots, and the grassroots have always had power. It says the unwillingness of the power structure to make available to all Americans a credible shot at the strategic resources of our society. The two in question that they named, jobs and freedom. Now, we don't see that as a social resource, what is in fact is. And the reasons that we have all these 50th anniversaries of this and civil rights that is a reminder that more than half a century has passed when certain groups absolutely have been denied and continue to be denied these critical opportunities of access. How do we measure the cumulative loss, the cumulative impact, the cumulative inability to build wealth, to own a home, to get a very sound education so that you can credibly compete in the marketplace or launch your own business? These are the ways we are to interpret our political reality, not just as some kind of emotional task that we fulfill, and we have some evangelical calling to just, you know, because people have died. People have died for all kinds of things in the United States. People died just simply for the right to breathe, the right to walk down the street, the right to get married to whoever you want to get married to. The right to read. People have died for that. So it is no greater a punishment about voting and not voting than it was simply to read. We have to understand these things in perspective. The story that we constantly tell when we call for civil rights, the story we ought to be reminded of that we are telling without recognizing it, is that we are telling the story of deprivation of access to strategic resources that, in fact, all these people who are suffering, they have contributed to and therefore are entitled to feed at the table. They're entitled to get their needs met. This is not a privilege. This is a demand. So it means that we have to redefine democracy. We need to understand it very differently from the way we understand it now. And we need to be truthful about the fact that for huge swaths of people, huge classes of people in this country, this experience of democracy simply does not apply based on the facts. The poor who are poor today have always been poor. They're poorer still. More people are joining the ranks of the poor. The rich are very ridiculously rich. 400 people having the equivalent wealth of the gross domestic product of Russia. Imagine that. Now I come to a really important part, and that is, can we do something about it? Yes, you can. Uh-oh, did I just give myself away with that slogan? Yes, we can. What I mean is, if we define the problem differently, we see, therefore, what we have to do. And that is, we have to confront this system and teach it a lesson. The wealthy Americans got really, really wealthy despite the economic downturn in 2008 and the ensuing years, which have been very lean, disastrous for most Americans. And yet, not only have the wealthy recouped their losses, they actually made even more money. The political apparatus that enables that, therefore, should be called into account. And the political apparatus that was in charge as of 2008 is none other than our dear president, Mr. Barack Obama. We can therefore reasonably conclude that if in the midst of all this tragedy, the downturn in the economy, the devastation, if in fact it is the political apparatus, the government that regulates both these resources and access to them, it stands to reason that the government also is responsible for creating this chasm where you have very, very wealthy people and the rest of people catching hell. If government is in charge of these things, regulating these things, and they're not well distributed, and people don't have reasonable access to all of these resources that comprise any modern society, then you have no choice but to point to government. And government, of course, is Obama and his administration, and it is Congress, generally. All forms of government, city government, state government, the federal government, government is responsible. And since we, the people, are responsible for selecting these folks that we call the government, ultimately we bear the responsibility for changing government. But we're not sending any signals, really. We're not sending credible signals at all that we are interested in change. Actually, it's the opposite. We're sending signals to reinforce that even in our distress, we still look to the same rotten levels of government to solve our problem. And this tells you that we're slightly nuts. We're not thinking right. But I'm suggesting that the time has come for a sober evaluation of the rights of citizens with respect to a so-called democratic process and a government. We have to reshape the nature of the relationship between the governed, that's us, and those who are elected to govern. Since this is a democratic administration, we could start there because they have the power. And there are unique things about this particular administration. This administration literally was created out of nothing. A miracle was wrought by common, regular people to place our guy in office. And it has had ripple effects. But the people did an extraordinary thing by just attaching themselves to the possibility of hope for change and making the requisite investment overwhelmingly for that change, putting in place and basically doing the job of creating the opportunity and the possibility for change through the agency of these bright new minds coming into office. And what do we find? That opportunity was lost. We have the rich and the wealthy, the oligarchs are in charge. It's all about money. The wealthiest people in the United States are running the country. The president seems only to be a symbol of authority. But his job is, in effect, to carry out the wishes of the wealthy. In politics, that calls for punishment. You know how Syria is to be punished for using chemicals, waging chemical warfare, and the moral obligation that the country has to punish Syria. That's our attitude. That should be our attitude. Our attitude should be we have to punish a government that has so badly misbehaved and betrayed the trust and has blocked opportunity and has created two Americas, the rich and the rest, and that has, in fact, done a number of things to forfeit the future of children born today. This is not a joke. This is serious business. I keep repeating that we have to be ruthless and obsessive about our interests. And in whatever way we can do that, to literally, we have to tear up the very thing we created. We have to tear it up. Create something new to replace it, but certainly don't contribute to that system because it has proven itself to be useless. And not only useless, but in fact very dangerous with respect to our shared interests. We can find money for war, but the president closes down schools. There are people who have no health insurance. Unemployment in certain quarters of our country, we talked about that often, African-American and Latino unemployment is sky high. The teenage unemployment in these groups is intolerably high. The rate of incarceration is unmatched in the world. These are the measures of whether a democracy is working. You can't call it a democracy. You can't call this democracy. You have to call it something else. But more importantly, you have to do something else to correct it because you and I and the rest of us are being punished because our access is blocked. Our right to reasonable access to these strategic resources that we should have. We see our rights completely diminished by law and by will. So, are you ready? That's the question. I'll take a break right here and we'll come back to your comments right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Your calls at 888-874-4888. Dave, thank you for calling from New York.
No, this is Jerry Eutrice. How are you?
Oh, Jerry. Sorry.
J-A-Y.
Oh, Jay. All right. Hello.
Eutrice, I kind of, in a sense, disagree with you. I think that one of the biggest problems is that most of the people who participate in politics do not understand what is in their best interest. I mean, if you look at this situation, what's going on with the debt ceiling and these so-called crazy Tea Partiers talking about shutting down the government. Now, in the process, they're talking about cutting all sorts of social services and programs. Now, what's so dishonest about the whole thing is that most of those people in the red states are the ones who benefit from these programs. And in the process, when these programs are cut, are going to be the ones that's going to suffer the most. Now, one would ask, why are they going along with this? Because the sad thing in the sickness is they choose not to wish for people of color to get anything. And that's the thing that just amazes me is, you know, you would rather hurt yourself to keep a person or who you perceive a person of color getting something in this country.
But you know what, Jay, I have to ask you, I'm sorry, there's a lag here. I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm cutting you off. There's just a lag, okay? So I'm very sorry if it sounds like that. But here's the thing. The scenario you just laid out is exactly the issue I'm referring to. The fact that we have yielded our leverage. We exempt ourselves from the drama. We sit by and say, okay, let's see how it turns out. No.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that, though.
But our job is to inflict deep wounds. That's how, look, we gotta get ready for war. This is not about observing what they're doing. You know, we are not supposed to be passive observers. We are supposed to be protecting the integrity and value of our vote. And when people do these things, I'm just, my dream is that one day somebody would get the message. You can't mess around with these folks. They will hurt you. They will put you out of office. They will cancel your political contract. That's what we need to do. We have yielded our leverage. That's the bottom line. And we can't say that the Tea Party people are looking after their interests and their people in the same way that the Democrats have the prison industrial complex. You understand? There are entire cities that are functioning on the basis of the incarceration of people in the United States. So there are no clean hands here. So this is why I say get interest focused and be ruthless. When they do these outrageous things, it ought to be understood implicitly that that's the last time they will do any such thing. They will be out. And we have to be very assertive about this, the nature of democracy, what we mean by democracy, not what they tell you it is to show up and vote. That's not democracy. As I've just told you, democracy is about access to resources, access that you are entitled to. And you're not, you know, it's not about you saying, well, this person shouldn't be rich, or that person shouldn't have a good life, and that other person shouldn't enjoy luxuries. No. It's about the vast majority of people basically on the outs. And the notion that we have to get it clear, something has happened. This thing that they're calling democracy isn't smelling like it, ain't feeling like it, it's just not looking like it. Thanks, Jay. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. It's always a
Hello.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Same here. Thank you.
You know, I was reading the New York Times today that back in last Thursday, they did a Gallup poll that found that 1 in 5 Americans say they struggled to afford food in the last year, and that and that access to basic needs is near a record low, and that that would be 20% found it hard to find food.
Now, talk about resources, right?
Yeah.
Food is a resource.
Here's the extreme levels of inequality are politically unattainable and morally unacceptable, and eventually the 99% will demand better. That's the end of that article. But I question why people elect rich people to begin with. Why is Bloomberg, who has $27 billion, why do we choose him for 3 terms? I don't live in New York, but why is he chosen for 3 terms to be the leader of that community?
Okay, I could ask you, why is it that almost the entire Senate is made up of multimillionaires?
Exactly. Why do we elect the rich people? Are they the ones that are going to look out for the 99%, or are they going to protect their and enhance their own interests and the interests of those that they're beholden to? And why do we demonstrate for jobs and freedom? Here's an issue. I'm asking the question. Mm-hmm. Why do we demonstrate for jobs and freedom? The jobs we get are abusive. They don't have the income for a livable wage. They don't provide basic necessities, and they're tremendously exploitive. Why do we campaign for that? Why do we merely request reform? Don't we need radical change at this point?
Well, Americans are certainly not as involved in their interests and protecting their interests. I'm talking about the vast majority of Americans who need to be far more involved in it and to see what their interests are.
Dutrice, do they really know their interests? Obama, I heard one speech. Obama said in one of his speeches there, he said, you've got to fight for a place at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen to that statement. This is from the leader of the free world. You, as a citizen, have to fight for your place at the table. Now, imagine the typical mom out there saying, to her kids, they hear Johnny and Billy, you guys fight it out to see who's going to eat tonight.
No, but this is the point. We have to see, it's as equally repugnant as a president standing in the shadow of Lincoln and telling folks out there, who are commemorating the 50 years that they haven't gotten very much. The road is long and it won't be easy. I mean, what is that? The reason he's elected is not that people should fight.
Hello?
For place at the table. The reason he's elected is that he should clear the table. That's his job. His job should have been to go in and clear the table and reorganize the feast. That's what I mean about resources. When you have in this so-called democratic society people who have no access to food, and the vast majority of them are children,
and you're asking them to fight for a place at the table.
That's my point. So it shows you, if when you hear this language, what should be happening in our brains is that this person no longer is useful. This person is not at all in touch with what is happening in my neck of the woods. This person has already taken sides with a whole other group of people who had nothing to do with him being there. And with that, there's no reason, really, that Barack Obama should have had a second term.
Absolutely.
There's no reason for it. But in as much as he's there, the will should be to make this a very memorable lesson to the Democratic Party. I keep saying that. since the Democratic Party has been so offensive to the needs of people, so oblivious to the needs of people, this administration, this Democratic administration, it is important to teach it a lesson. Walk away from it and leave it. Let it wither and die on the vine. Because in any event, leverage is with the people. The people have the right and they have the power to change all of this, to change the dynamics. But we're not doing it.
Well, you know, I think, you know, they're out there demonstrating for jobs and freedom. But I think that their interests should be first to demonstrate for a good society.
Well, you know, there is in a sense it's a tradition.
Fighting for a place at the table is not that society.
The thing is, the society itself is bifurcated. The society is really two Americas, and increasingly it's three and four Americas, depending on where you are with respect to the access your group has, you know. And so it is imperative that we become sensitive to each other's, how each other has been bruised. And where groups can work together, they certainly should work together for a shared interest and common cause. But there ought to be some kind of movement away from the system because it's not working. It hasn't worked. All the statistics are telling us that. We stare at these statistics. We know them. We know them to be true in our bones, but still we are reluctant to exert the pressure that we have. We have pressure. We have the power to change things. And still we go along with the system that oppresses. And this is bewildering to me.
Yes, because I think that you know, we need, that's why I always said that self-knowledge is the most important thing. We need a psychological revolution before we need any outward revolution. We have to know who we are and what we need and what we want and why. And we don't seem to know those things, so we become fragmented immediately. I don't see why do we don't put our energies into something that will help us. Why don't we campaign to strengthen, fortify, establish a strong welfare state?
It should start soon, and let's hope that people are getting the message that it's way long overdue that something of that sort should start. Thank you, Michael, for calling.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, we have come to the end of our program today. Of course, you could always drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com or on the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me hear from you and what you're thinking. And let's convene again tomorrow at the same time, a very good program for tomorrow. I hope it will be of use and of value to you. But I thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company and pass the word that PRN is your preferred stop for information. And, of course, Lead Stories, your very favorite program. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. Take care.